I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The juvenile justice system has undergone a dramatic transformation in the last decade, driven by U.S. Supreme Court decisions on the death penalty and life sentences without parole. There's also more scientific research about the teenage brain to help understand judgment and decision-making. But that doesn't mean there aren't problems with juvenile justice. Exhibit A is the Cash for Kids scandal in Pennsylvania. And that was a kickback scheme that involved two judges in Luzerne County who sent teens to private detention facilities with little or no representation in court. The two judges are in prison and thousands of convictions have been overturned. One of the developers just agreed to pay almost $5,000 in a settlement. Our guest, Marcia Levick, is deputy director, chief counsel, and co-founder of the Juvenile Law Center here in Philadelphia that brought the scandal to light. I should add that the Law Center is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. And Marcia served on the state's Juvenile Act Advisory Committee that just released a series of recommendations. Marcia Levick, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
We seem to always be talking about the Cash for Kids scandal, but that's because I guess it still continues to reverberate. For those people new to Pennsylvania or even new to what happened those couple of years ago, can you encapsulate it?
Sure. The Kids for Cash case was about really allegations of both a kickback scheme that involved two judges in Luzerne County, one of them the juvenile court judge and one the administrative judge, who had participated in kind of facilitating the building of a private for-profit juvenile detention center. Ultimately, the scheme involved a former co-owner of the facility as well as the developer who built the facility. There have been a series of legal proceedings. There have been now three settlements in the case. One most recently, there have been civil proceedings involving the kids as well that led to those settlements. Both judges were criminally charged and convicted. And really the last piece of the case that we're waiting on now is actually the two judges who, in addition to having been sentenced to fairly lengthy prison terms, there are judgments out against both of them as a consequence of the civil litigation. Those judgments need to be reduced to a monetary settlement. And when that's done, probably in early 2016, the case will be over for all intents and purposes.
And we're talking about the two judges, 17 years and 28 years, so pretty lengthy sentences.
Very lengthy sentences, that's correct.
And the judge that oversaw this case, Judge Chivarella, I read, wants a new trial.
So we've heard. Yes, we'll see how that goes.
We were talking actually before the show began about a number of the kids that actually were featured in a film about this Kids for Cash scandal, about how they're doing. Can you say to our listeners, and we were talking really only about five kids, but it's sort of represents, I think, a broad spectrum of a number of these kids.
I think the experiences that you see from the five kids who are featured in the film is probably representative down through the 2,500 roughly kids who were involved in the Kids for Cash scandal. These are kids who all appeared before Judge Chivarella in a five-year period. And I think that the outcomes are varied. We have some kids who are doing terrifically well, but the process of being both adjudicated delinquent, removed from your families, taken from your communities, school disruption, all of those things leave scars. And our experience over and over again, working with the kids in Luzerne County, our work with Juvenile Law Center, is that it is for many kids difficult to remove that. And they struggle, and many of them are still struggling with their engagement today.
Well, and we're talking about minor offenses in some cases, and no offense at all.
Exactly. And I think that's one of the real tragedies of Luzerne County. And I know we'll be talking soon with some of the legislative responses to that. But yes, the vast majority, probably 80 to 90% of the kids involved in Luzerne County were charged with very, very minor offenses, some misdemeanors and literally some not offenses at all.
And can we say in 2015 that with confidence that Pennsylvania has put an end to this kind of judicial system? what happened in Luzerne County? Is that happening anywhere else in Pennsylvania?
I think that if we pulled the pieces apart, we could knock off most of what happened in Luzerne County, not happening anywhere else in Pennsylvania, and certainly not happening there. The big story of Luzerne County, which was really the school-to-prison pipeline and the pushing of kids from schools into the justice system, we're not through that yet. Mm-hmm. We haven't yet been able to say goodbye to that. And again, I think that's part of Senator Casey's interest in some of his legislation. That's a problem that continues to exist throughout the country, but we are making progress, absolutely.
In what way?
I think that there's a growing recognition across the whole spectrum of juvenile and, frankly, criminal justice reform that America is very out of step with the way that we approach punishing individuals who commit even the most minor offenses. And as we examine the cost and the human cost associated with that, I think that we're seeing a reexamination of policies from top to bottom. And I think that the school-to-prison pipeline is very much a part of that reexamination and a willingness to just try to do things differently.
I mentioned in my introduction some of this new research on the teenage brain. We've actually done a number of shows about that. Is that important in understanding juvenile justice?
It is, because I think that what the research really crystallized for anybody who's paying attention is that not just from a common sense perspective that kids are different, we all know that, but from a scientific perspective, kids are different. And that research has really forced lawmakers, judges, policymakers, stakeholders working in the justice system to look at kids differently and to calibrate their responses differently because of their reduced culpability and other just obvious natural impairments that come with being a teenager and being an adolescent. So it's been groundbreaking, and I think we're in the midst of it. We're not done yet.
How much do you think these for-profit detention centers, though, are part of the problem when we talk about reforming juvenile justice?
I think that any time that you put profit into the justice system and give people an opportunity to make money from jailing kids as well as adults, you're headed for trouble. We actually, in Pennsylvania, the for-profit centers that were involved in the Kids for Cash case were actually the only for-profit centers in the state. It's much more of an issue in the South. States like Mississippi, Louisiana, Florida are well known for still running and permitting for-profit providers to run jails and prisons in those states. And we see the consequences of that.
What happens inside a detention facility? We'll be talking about kids that are in the adult system and the problems there. But when there are in, let's say, a good detention facility, are they getting treatment? Are they getting an education?
A good detention center, yes, is providing both treatment and education. And I think most importantly, what you want a detention center to be, which is really a pretrial holding facility, is a place where kids are not there for more than 3, 5, 7 days. So in some respects, it's a little bit less about treatment. It's about identifying, is there an acute problem here that we need to address, whether it's a mental health issue or a physical health issue, but also education, trying to limit the disruption that kids experience when they're pulled out of a school program. It's difficult for many kids involved in the juvenile justice system. As we know, our public school system is deeply struggling here in Philadelphia and throughout the state. And so whatever we can do in a detention center when kids wind up there to keep that educational experience going is really quite critical.
And how does Pennsylvania compare to other states when it comes to either locking up or charging juveniles?
We're kind of in the middle. We do a lot of things very well. We have actually we do have pretty low rates of stay for kids who are in detention centers. I think the average number of days that kids stay in detention centers is probably under a week. And I think we do that very well. We have reduced the numbers of kids that we are confining after they've been adjudicated delinquent, like every state has. Some would say that we haven't reduced our rates as fast as other states, but we're reducing it. We've closed some facilities. So we're all heading in the right direction.
I'd also mention some Supreme Court decisions over the last, what, decade or so, but I think it's important that listeners understand what the court said.
Well, what the court has said is that kids cannot be, basically can't be sentenced in the same way as adults. That is the big message that has come out of the Supreme Court. They've also said that kids can't be interrogated by police when they are suspects in crimes in the same way that we interrogate adults in terms of assuming that they'll understand what it means to waive counsel or to answer questions. As I said, these are all pretty groundbreaking ideas that are still percolating through the system, and we're still seeing how far those changes might go.
I mean, haven't sort of trickled down into actual changes in the law or changes in the system?
They have trickled down to reducing the extreme sentences on the very high end. So kids can't be executed in this country. That seems remarkable that we would acknowledge that that's a good thing. At the time that we eliminated that in 2005, we were the only country in the world that executed children for crimes that they committed as children. They can no longer be subjected to mandatory life without parole sentences. That's a good thing. But again, we are pretty much alone in the world in terms of imposing those kinds of sentences. Juveniles who commit non-homicide crimes, we could be talking about robbery, burglary, even a rape, can no longer receive a life without parole sentence. And that decision came down just 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. So progress has been slow, but we have also taken some very bold steps.
And this seems to go back to a couple of decades, perhaps to, I guess, the late 80s or the 1980s, when there was this notion of these juvenile super predators.
Right. I think the really the great metaphor for, I think, what we've seen in the juvenile justice system especially is just this pendulum swing. The system started in 1899 as really a treatment and rehabilitation focused system that did create and separate itself from the adult system because it did think kids were different. We had a huge swing in the 1980s and early 90s where we became very punitive. We really rejected all notions that kids should be treated differently than adults. The mantra of the time was adult time for adult crime, as if one could characterize what a child did was suddenly an adult act. And that led to, interestingly, I think the Supreme Court decisions of the last decade, which really was a response to the consequences when we had so many children who were being subjected to these extreme sentences in the adult system, combined with the research that coincidentally was coming out of the MacArthur Research Network. The Supreme Court paid attention and really responded in a very, very direct way.
Should we think about our juvenile justice system about giving juveniles a second chance? Is that sort of at the heart of it?
It's absolutely at the heart of it. And I'm glad that you use that term. I think that the juvenile justice system has been from the beginning about being a second chance system, that kids make mistakes. Some of them make terrible mistakes. Some of them make violent and serious mistakes. But we know now from so much research that has been pulled together that the vast majority of kids, even those who commit serious crimes, will desist. They will cease being engaged in criminal activity by their mid-20s. And so we as a society, we need to balance some concern for accountability, some concern for retribution that victims seek, but also recognizing that kids will not persist and that we need to give them that second chance to get back into society.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about our juvenile justice system, and that's Marsha Levick, Deputy Director, Chief Counsel, co-founder of the Juvenile Law Center. That's a nonprofit public interest law firm here in Philadelphia. And we have waiting in the wings Pennsylvania Senator Bob Casey. He has introduced some legislation to address sentencing and juveniles. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. And we have comments coming in at Radio Times at WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. I need to correct a few things that I said in my introduction, talking about it should be the former co-owner of one of these detention facilities has agreed to pay not $5,000 in a settlement, but almost $5 million. So Marsha Levick corrected me off air, and I'm glad that she did, and obviously correcting it on the air. Joining us now is Pennsylvania Senator Robert Casey. He just introduced legislation with Kentucky Senator Rand Paul that would prohibit detention for juveniles who committed status offenses, things like truancy and violating curfew. We asked Senator Casey to join us to tell us why this act is good for juveniles and good for society. And Senator Casey, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty, great to be with you. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And I read that you were inspired in part by this Kids for Cash scandal here in Pennsylvania, that's in part where your legislation or your bill has come from.
Yeah, there's no question. This tragedy was so horrific. It's probably the worst judicial scandal in the United States of America ever, at least at a county or local level. And I want to commend Marcia and her team and the folks who helped to shine, not just to shine a spotlight on the abuse and the injustice, but also to give these young people a way out of the darkness. So we commend them. And then the Robert Mays film, Kid for Cash, was among the most moving, not just documentaries, but among the most moving films I've ever seen. So that helped to focus our attention and get folks in Washington ever more concerned about this one defect in the law, which went into effect in 1984, which basically, for as you explained, if you have a status offense, which these are acts which would not be, and that's the operative distinction here, would not be considered crimes if they were committed by an adult, whether it's truancy or breaking curfew or running away from home. Those status offenses were used as kind of the loophole, I guess I would say, under the law from 1984, used as a loophole to have a lot of kids locked up and be on a pathway to detention for a good part of their lives.
And it sounds like what your act would do would be to, I guess, prevent these nonviolent youth offenders from being incarcerated for some of these status offenses. So the idea is to keep these young people that, let's say, are truant or perhaps break curfew, to keep them out of any kind of detention facility.
Right. These are instances where not only is it nonviolent, but it's a circumstance where it's not even a crime if that individual were an adult. But for some reason, 1984, the law was amended to allow judges to issue detention orders in these so-called status offense cases if that offense violated a valid court order. So this valid court order exemption led to thousands, if not tens of thousands, over 30 years to be incarcerated. And we can see some of the impacts, the adverse impacts on young people in the Kids for Cash movie.
Indeed. It's interesting you've teamed up with Senator Rand Paul on this particular issue. It's nice to see some bipartisanship at work in Washington. How do you think it's going to fare?
Well, I think we've been able to get it through the Judiciary Committee, and that's rather difficult, as you can imagine.
Right.
And sometimes the only way is to have a Republican co-sponsor who happens, in this case, to be on the committee. And Rand Paul has, in some ways, broken from some of the what I would argue is Republican.
The phone line is breaking up a little bit. Why don't we try to call Senator Casey back, see if we can get a better phone line. But let me give you, Marcia Levick, a chance to weigh in on this. So what Senator Casey's talking about are these status offenses and in a sense, decriminalizing them.
Exactly. And I think that it was certainly an unfortunate development in 1984, as Senator Casey was referring to, this notion that judges could find kids in contempt for running away from a facility or doing something that was contrary to whatever this court order was, and in effect criminalizing that behavior, right, pushing more kids into the juvenile justice system. The legislation that he's introduced, which we are hopeful about, and I think his point about the bipartisan nature of much of the reform effort that we're seeing in Congress right now has also really been essential to, I think, our opportunities for good outcomes here.
Well, interesting. And is the idea that if, let's say, a student is truant a lot, I mean, is the idea, if not sending them to a facility, doing what with them?
Well,
what's the alternative?
Yes, I mean,
what's the alternative?
Well, the alternative is to deal with why they're truant. You know, this is actually a pretty common sense question to ask. And historically, many jurisdictions around the country have been willing to look at truancy as something that they could criminalize. And mm-hmm. if kids weren't going to school, they would remove them from their homes and send them to facilities where often the educational environment was not conducive to whatever they may have been struggling with in their traditional school environment. And truancy in particular, which is certainly something that, of course, is a status offense, has been deemed that, has captured a lot of attention right now. There was mm-hmm. just a significant amount of reform undertaken in Texas on exactly that issue, that where there was a process whereby so many kids who were considered to be truant across the state were being pushed into the juvenile justice system. And this kind of legislation that Senator Casey has introduced is really taking direct mm-hmm. aim at those kinds of practices.
You know, it's interesting to think of our juvenile justice system and our adult justice system as well, and whether we are using them to solve more and more psychological problems, social problems, cultural problems?
It's a great question. You know, the dialogue that we're seeing right now in newspapers every day around the juvenile justice and criminal justice system, we are reading stories about solitary confinement. Yeah. We're reading stories about sex offenders who are being civilly committed for endless, indeterminate periods of time with virtually no due process. We are reading stories about, as in the Texas story, of all of these kids who have been truant, who are not receiving the opportunity to address what their schooling and educational problems are. And we need to take a step back and think, what is the purpose of our justice system?
Yeah.
You know, it is partly about public safety, partly about managing risk. But when the risk is low, which is true for so many juvenile offenders, we can't treat every problem, you know, as if it's a nail and the only tool we have is a hammer. And that's often what our response has been.
Well, let me reintroduce you. And I'm told that Senator Casey's going to try to call us back. But in the meantime, we have a third guest who's been waiting patiently and quietly here in our Philadelphia studio. Lauren Fine is co-founder of the Youth Sentencing and Reentry Project. It's a local resource center for lawyers representing kids in the adult criminal justice system. And Lauren Fine, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. I'm grateful to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you here as well. And your project is about a year old.
That's right.
What was the spark, the genesis for this?
Well, actually, I was fortunate enough to work with Marcia at Juvenile Law
Center. Small world here in Philadelphia.
It
yes.
is, but a very strong one. And we were doing litigation work and specifically around kids who were serving juvenile life without parole sentences. And here in Pennsylvania, we have the highest number of kids serving juvenile life without parole in the country, about 20%. And in doing some of that litigation work, we were working with lawyers who are appointed by the court to represent kids in cases where the public defender's office had a conflict of interest. So, for example, if there are four kids who are charged with one offense, three of those kids will not be able to be represented by the public defender office because there's a conflict. And we saw that court-appointed lawyers just weren't receiving the same amount of resources and support as the public defender here in Philadelphia, which is a very strong office, has social workers on staff, investigators, was receiving, and we wanted to do something about that.
And we're talking about young people that have been charged or are being charged within the adult system.
That's correct. So kids who are kind of outside of, when we talk about juvenile justice reform, kids who are in an entirely separate system.
And what have they been charged with? What are we talking about?
Sure. So the offenses are on the more severe end, and they're considered to be violent offenses in all cases here in Pennsylvania, so up to homicide. But a robbery may include, for example, five kids, and one of those kids may have been the lookout on the corner who is now being charged with a violent offense, not having ever held a weapon or really participated in any kind of violent way in any kind of action.
And let me go to you, Marcia, and then we've got Senator Casey back on the line again. From your perspective, should a juvenile ever be charged as an adult?
Well, I think that's a great question, and I'm going to duck it in the sense that I think that it's difficult to say that there are no circumstances under which juveniles should be charged as an adult. That's not the question. To me, the issue is how we respond to their behavior. And right now, to respond only with this either-or juvenile or adult system where you have this extreme sentencing on the adult side, that's where the system is broken. It's really a sentencing issue and an accountability issue.
Well, let me get to Senator Casey back on the line, and I'm sorry to do that to you, but you were breaking up, and we wanted to make sure our listeners had a chance to hear that everything that you said, and you were talking about your bill having to do with status offenses. What happens next?
Yeah, thank you. We were in rural Brooks County, so we got cut off from the phone.
That's all right.
So basically what it will do is it eliminates the use of these so-called valid court order exemptions, which under current law permits states to place a young person who violates a youth status offense, allows that court or that judge to have that individual placed in a detention facility. So we'll eliminate that exemption or exception. Secondly, it would provide time for states to adjust to this, to make this change. And then thirdly, it would provide procedural safeguards for states phasing out the use of this exception. So it would cut down on some of the abuses that were evident in the Kids for Cash scandal, although in that case there were so many abuses that probably not one law could rectify all of them. They, as you know, had such gross and outrageous constitutional violations that actually had to be, the changes there have to take place at a county and local level.
And I was reading a press release from your office about this valid court order, the idea of ending this valid court order, letting states put offenders into secure facilities, used largely against minority youth, against girls, and against LGBT youth as well. I want to make sure our listeners understand that.
Yeah, it's hard to comprehend that it's been we've allowed this to persist for so many years now, even decades. Yeah, the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention said that this so-called valid court order exception was used to detain status offenders over 8,000 times in the year 2010 alone.
Wow.
So that's gives you the sense of the scope of it.
Senator, we have an email from Richard. He says, while I support the principles of the legislation proposed by Senators Casey and Paul, what gives the federal government jurisdiction should this not be a state matter? What do you say in response?
Yeah, I wish this was something where the federal government didn't have to get involved, because a lot of this plays out at the state and local level. But in this case, we have a 1974 law, the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act, which was changed in 1984, which allowed this status offenses valid court order problem to arise. So this defect in the law has been there since 1984. And it has to be changed by way of federal law.
And does that make sense to you, Marcia?
Yeah, and I think that I would also underscore that Senator Casey's involvement in this also reflects the importance of federal leadership. Huh. It's true that a lot of juvenile justice policy, of course, plays out at the state level, but the federal government still has a leadership role to play by establishing really what is at least a floor in terms of what is permissible behavior. It makes a difference in terms of how we run systems locally.
And Senator, before we say goodbye to you, do you expect this to be picked up in the fall when the Senate gets back in session?
Yeah, we have it out of committee now, which is very helpful, and we have to just figure out a way to make sure that we get it passed now. But having it out of the Judiciary Committee in such a short time frame is it may not have set a record, but it's rare to have action this quickly. This is the second Congress that I've introduced, but it's moving in the right direction, and obviously having bipartisan support is key to this.
Well, Senator Bob Casey, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Marty, thank you, and thanks for your guests and especially for their work.
Saying you're welcome from Marcia Levick and also from our other guest, Lauren Fine, as well. And that's a Democratic senator of Pennsylvania, recently introduced bipartisan juvenile justice reform legislation to Congress. This is a little weird show because we're toggling back and forth between the senator and also with you, Lauren Fine, and obviously with Marcia Levick as well. Going back to, I guess, juveniles charged in the adult system, are charged with crimes that, I guess, involve some kind of violence. Is the goal to get these young people out of the adult system or to ensure that their rights are protected?
It's both. our primary goal is to get kids out of the juvenile justice system and sometimes out of systems entirely when it's appropriate, and make sure that we're, as Marcia alluded to, actually addressing the underlying issues that may have brought them into court. So treating them in a manner that's actually going to be both helpful to them but helpful to all of us as a community and help them move forward.
Give us an example of what you mean by that.
Sure.
The underlying issues.
Sure. So drug and alcohol abuse is often present in these cases, and if we're sending kids to a facility where they're not likely to receive as much supportive treatment or therapy. There's been a great report out recently on girls in the justice system who have particular issues. That's particularly acute in girls who are charged as adults. So trauma histories, histories of domestic and physical abuse, and that's not something that the adult criminal justice system is well equipped to really treat in a meaningful way. So we're trying to give judges and prosecutors options that show how we can be more thoughtful in addressing some of what's actually being going on in a young person's life.
And the juvenile justice system can deal with those issues in a better way?
It's certainly much more equipped than the adult criminal justices, with basic things, education being principal among them. And Marcia's talked a bit about some of the educational challenges of being in the juvenile justice system, but those are even more severe when you're talking about a kid who's put in an adult jail, an adult prison, that's simply not set up to serve their educational or other needs.
Marcia, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think that one of the most pronounced differences between the criminal and juvenile justice systems in this country is that the criminal justice system is largely retributive. It's concerned with punishment, and it's concerned with revenge in terms of a state-sanctioned way. The juvenile justice system is meant to be rehabilitative and treatment-oriented, and that means that for young people who even commit serious crimes, when they are prosecuted and sentenced as adults, they go into facilities that have no capacity, have no programming that is designed to address both basic developmental needs. They go in at 14, 15, 16 years old. They're still going through their developmental trajectory, compounded by the fact that they don't have school programs set up to deal with someone who might still be in high school or to address the kinds of trauma that so many kids who find themselves in the criminal justice system have experienced. So it's a mismatch by the most extreme measure.
And we're almost having a break here, and I'm assuming targets for abuse in an adult system, if you have a 14 or 15 or 16-year-old?
Yes, much higher rates of both self-abuse, self-harm, as well as assaultive behavior from other inmates.
And that's Marcia Levick, again, Deputy Director, Chief Counsel, co-founder of the Juvenile Law Center. Also with us here in our Philadelphia studio is Lauren Fine, co-founder of the Youth Sentencing and Reentry Project. And we are talking about our juvenile justice system. I do want to get some callers in on the conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I see some emails, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. All of that to join our conversation. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with Lauren Fine and also with Marcia Levick about our juvenile justice system here in the state of Pennsylvania. Let me read an email from Eileen, and she writes, I have a personal reason to respond. My sister was murdered by a 15-year-old. He was treated as a juvenile. It's very difficult to know that he's free today, but my sister never had a chance at anything. This was many years ago. There's no justice for us. This is much different from the teen who's involved in a nonviolent crime, and I do think that kids can be helped. So she's acknowledging the fact and very generously that for a lot of teenagers, they do deserve a second chance. But this is, you know, Lauren, this is someone who was murdered by a 15-year-old.
Absolutely. And I'm so sorry for that loss and for all the losses that are present in cases where people have experienced great tragedy. I think the important thing to keep in mind is just what are we going to do going forward and how are we going to make this intervention that our system is doing the most productive and the most thoughtful possible so that everyone can heal and grow and move forward.
What do you think, Marcia?
Well, I think that's right. So many individuals whom we encounter have really experienced tragedies that most of us can't even fathom. But our job is to try to separate out what society's appropriate response is to that harm that has been experienced. And I think right now there's a growing consensus that the response from the United States, from our government in these kinds of cases, has been too extreme, and that we just need to figure out a better way to manage that risk and to respond to that harm.
And Lorna, I'm curious about how much your project, your organization works with families. I mean, if we're talking about, let's say, a 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old, what's the role that the family plays here?
It's a huge role. And in some cases, there hasn't been consistent family support, and that may have contributed to why a young person finds themselves in this situation. But to the extent that there's biological family or other supporters, it's absolutely critical to the work that we do that they be as involved as possible. So a big part of the work we're doing is planning for reentry, whether that's from the juvenile system or the adult criminal justice system. What is going to happen on the other side of this situation, and how can we make sure that someone has a stable place to live, has good educational pathways, has health care set up, has all of the basic fundamental things that are going to allow them to have choices going forward and not have them revolve back in the system. And family being broadly defined is critical to that.
And reentry is such a critical point in this process, Marcia.
Yes. We have found, and I think particularly in some of these cases where there have been opportunities to get some of these young people out who have been in prison for extended periods of time for very serious acts, that having a good reentry program makes the difference. You're talking about individuals who largely grew up in an institutional environment, in a penal environment, and having a community set of supports, whether it's their families or friends or even faith-based groups, other community groups that are willing to really help provide them some stability, the opportunity for a job, to not be shunned by their communities, makes all the difference in terms of their successful reintegration.
I do want to get some callers in on the conversation, but Marcia, why is Pennsylvania so tough on juveniles? I mean, you look at some of the stats and we stand out.
We stand out especially with respect to life without parole, and it's because for decades we have had a mandatory life without parole sentence for both second-degree murder and first-degree murder. So it means that the sentence has been imposed liberally and frequently, and it has put us in the position of having, as Lauren said, literally 20% of the entire juvenile life without parole population in the country.
Here in Pennsylvania.
Correct.
You want to add to that, Lauren?
No, we're just hopeful the U.S. Supreme Court is taking this case, Marcia's counsel on it, and we're hopeful that that's going to be meaningful for all the folks and their families who are serving that sentence.
I mean, that would be retroactively?
It's the issue of retroactivity, exactly.
Let me get, looks like Larry from Fishtown to join our conversation. Hi, Larry. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
This is a great show.
Thank you.
It happens to be something that I deal with all the time. I'm a neuroscientist. I'm from Fishtown. And want to just make two comments. One, we just can't decriminalize things and assume that that's going to solve the problem with regard to the truancy. You know, these kids or adults have done something that needs corrections. We don't want to just pass the cost to some other sector of our tax burden and our budgets. Now, with regard to corrections, I haven't heard the word brain used. And that's very
important. You haven't been listening, because we did use the word brain, but that's okay. Go ahead, Larry.
Well, with regard to children, you know, they're going to need, you know, nutritional issues that they have, the fatty acids and proper diet. Exercise is very important. But with children and adults, there's new brain therapies, brain mapping technologies, and things that can be done that are treatment-oriented to really grab at the circuitry that's not working right with the cause of the addiction or their hyper-aggressiveness or impulsivity or things like that, learning disabilities that are going to prevent them from really taking advantage of all the programs that we're going to be giving them.
Okay, Larry. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me pick up on the first thing you said, and I think we touched on this, but if a young person is truant and they're not going to school, Lauren, that's a problem.
It is a problem.
That's a problem,
and it's a problem that needs to be fixed for them and for all of us. I would argue that criminalizing truancy does not actually help address the issue. As the caller stated, it's something that does need to be intervened, but taking a kid out of the taking away the chance that a kid can actually fully participate in school, to me, doesn't cure truancy. It actually aggravates the situation and makes it much more likely that they're not going to return to school if they've been incarcerated.
And that is true, right?
Yes.
Once someone is incarcerated, their chance of returning to school
Their chance of returning to school diminishes drastically. I think the return rate for kids involved in the juvenile justice system going back to schools is about 60% of them never return to school. So that is that's not curing truancy.
Let me see what looks like Deborah from Malvern has to say. And Deborah, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you so much. This
You're
is
welcome.
Such a critical conversation.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask Marcia and Lauren. Many of these children, I work in special education, I'm not a teacher, but I do work in this arena. Many of these children who wind up in the juvenile justice system have underlying special education needs that have not been addressed and or mental health issues. And it's very frustrating for me in this arena, and I'm sure also for you, to understand what are we missing here? What are we missing prior to these children winding up in the juvenile justice system or winding up being arrested and charged as an adult? What should we be doing, and what are we missing?
Those are good questions, Deborah. I'm going to toss them to both of our guests. I'll start with you, Lauren. What are we missing?
Sure. Well, thank you for the call, and the work that you do is so important. And I think a lot of it does start in schools. And obviously here in Philadelphia, we've had school funding challenges that have made it even more likely that a child will end up in the justice system when they don't have supports in school that are going to be addressing the needs that they have, and special education being a huge one of them. Counseling in schools is absolutely critical, and that's been defunded by a lot of the cuts that we've experienced here in the Philadelphia school system. So there's a direct link, and people use the term school-to-prison pipeline all the time, and the senator mentioned it. But it's a very real thing, and I think a lot of referrals to the justice system start in schools, and it's a place that we can be strengthening the supports that we're offering.
You know, Marcia, sometimes you read about young people that have committed serious and violent offenses, and you read a little bit about their family, and you find out there's a parent who's in prison. There's a parent who's also using drugs, and you find incredible chaos.
There's a lot of chaos, and I think that Deborah's call also highlights that, you know, we have a system of financial supports in this country and here in Pennsylvania that we have buckets. And we've managed to put most of our money in the buckets at the end of the line. So we're very much focused on the response to behavior that happens after it happens and not focused on providing supports to families, to communities, the whole array of failed opportunities that we see going on in the schools right now. Philadelphia is the worst example in Pennsylvania, but we know it's certainly true in other parts of the state. We really need to reallocate our resources. It's not so much a resource that we're resource poor. We spend our resources improperly and not smartly. And as a consequence of that, we don't tend to needs when they arise, and then we see the consequences down at the other end.
And can we say if we reallocated that money at the front end, we can also ensure community safety? I mean, I'm sure there are people listening who say, look, I want to be protected from these criminals, no matter what age they are.
We can, because there's so much research now that has looked at the efficacy of locking people up. And the truth is that there's not much value there, that communities are just as safe and reoffense rates are no different whether you intervene with a period of long incarceration or a very short, focused intervention. So we don't risk public safety. And again, it's about just spending our dollars much more wisely.
Anything you want to add to that, Lauren?
No.
You don't have to. I'm just checking. Let me get Bob from, looks like Swarthmore, to join our conversation. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I wanted to ask about voting rights. When these children are improperly jailed and treated as adults, when they get out, do they have voting rights?
Hmm. It's a good question, Bob. In fact, it's something that I was reading about. And go ahead, Marcia.
Actually, the issue about felony disenfranchisement, as we call it, individuals who've been incarcerated and convicted who can't vote, that is fortunately not a problem in Pennsylvania. Once you have been released from prison, you are able to vote. So great question. It's something that is very very much discussed in other parts of the country.
But not Pennsylvania, here in Pennsylvania. But certainly in other states as well.
Yes.
And is that because records are expunged? I mean, is that – or just
– Oh, it's just we've just made the decision that so long as you're back out on the street, you're eligible to vote.
Good to know. Bob, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me ask you about expungement. I mean, and juvenile records, what are they? They're supposed to be expunged, or you have to ask that they be expunged? How does that work?
There are 50 different state responses to that question.
Okay.
Pennsylvania is pretty good at expunging records, but for the most part, what happens is that we are willing to expunge low-level records. So convictions and adjudications for low-level misdemeanors, nonviolent crimes, but not for violent crimes. And what that means is that those records will follow kids, and they have terrific consequences in terms of the not terrific in the sense of the volume of consequences. They inhibit children's ability to pursue higher education, to pursue certain employment opportunities, to pursue public housing if they are in a situation where they need it. And so for kids, the failure to expunge and to keep records confidential means that before they even get out of the gate, so I want to make a distinction here in a sense with adults. Adults get involved with the law. They commit criminal acts. They may come out, but they may have gone – when they went in, they may have had some employment history. For kids, they don't have that employment history when they get involved in the juvenile justice system. They have nothing to fall back on, and then we saddle them with this stain of some type of juvenile delinquency record that in many states will follow them, and some records follow them here in Pennsylvania. So it's very much a forefront issue for us that I think we need to be tackling.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I just want to add something to be very clear, that a juvenile record actually has to be proactively expunged by a young person. It doesn't disappear at age 18, which a lot of people, even people who have records, kind of assume. And in addition to that, even if you're charged with a crime and ultimately the charges are withdrawn, which happened in one of our cases, we've actually had to petition for expungement for the young person. The record will still follow you if you've had any kind of system contact, to the extent that the courts are involved. And so it's really important that people understand that it's not automatic.
Well, I'm curious, too, as you work with the court system here in Philadelphia, is there interest? Do you find that there's interest among judges, among lawyers, to begin to perhaps rethink juveniles in the adult system? Is it too soon to tell?
There's certainly been a lot of support for the work that we're doing in trying to inject a different way of thinking about young people and kind of humanizing their experience, their family's experience as well. And we've been grateful for support from the judge who handles cases of children charged as adults, Judge Lerner here in Philadelphia. And there is support as well from the district attorney's office and from the private bar, which is who we primarily work with. But we have a long way to go, and a lot of the fixes are legislative on the state level.
But does that tell us that there is some shifting in thinking, at least within judicial circles?
I think so. I think there's been a lot of conversation about juvenile justice on the national level, as we've been discussing, and it's starting to at least pierce the veil of this other category of young people who are not even touched by the juvenile justice system.
Go ahead, Marcia.
Yeah, I think that here in Philadelphia, we've been fortunate because really, it's, as it turns out, a majority of the cases that are subject to prosecution in the adult system that go before Judge Lerner here in Philadelphia, a majority of those cases go back to juvenile court.
Oh, interesting.
That's a good thing. But what's also interesting is that we're seeing more states around the country looking at this model where you do have judicial review, where you have a judge reexamining the decision by a prosecutor or in some instances by a legislature to target certain offenses or certain offenders for prosecution as an adult in the first instance. That's a huge change. We'd like to see that across the country, but having judges involved will lead to better outcomes.
I want to squeeze in a comment before we have to say goodbye. She from Suzanne says there's a show called Scared Straight. Think it's a wonderful program. Could they film something like that here, try to dissuade potential youth offenders? I know there's a lot of controversy actually about Scared Straight. It goes back a couple of decades, as I understand it. I'm looking at you, Lauren.
I don't know.
Scaring kids out of not committing crimes.
I don't know about the logistics of the show and whether it could be done here. I think that there is sort of an ethos of trying to scare kids. That's part of the way that we handle cases where young people are involved. I think in some cases it can be effective, but I think there needs to be a lot more of support as part of the way that we're talking to kids and sort of understanding not just what did you do, but why did you do it? And to me, Scared Straight kind of leaves out that important part of the discussion.
You're nodding.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's sort of the difference between negative reinforcement and positive reinforcement. And I think we do better when we try to prop up kids for the good things that they do and not scare them from doing bad things.
Well, that seems like the perfect place to end our conversation. My thanks to both of you. Thank you, Marsha Levick, for joining us once again on Radio Times, Deputy Director, Chief Counsel, Co-Founder of the Juvenile Law Center here in Philadelphia. And I should say the center is 40 years old this year. Congratulations on that. Lauren Fine, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
And she's co-founder of the Youth Sentencing and Reentry Project, a project that will be celebrating its 40th year in 39 years, just a year old. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.